The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition, the final one for the year 2021. We are recording this here in the last week of 2021. It'll air for the first time here. I think it's Wednesdays that these go out. So thanks for sticking with us for another year. If you found us new this year, welcome. If you're a longtime listener, thanks again. Special EDU show today. It's going to be kind of like a Q&A show. So I guess we can still call it the EDU show since it comes out on Wednesdays and that's when we do those. But where it's like an EDU show, we're going to be focused. This is going to be a tax-focused EDU show. But we're going to go over what we want to talk about today via the answering of several questions that have come in from people. So in that way, it's going to be like a Q&A. So we'll call it a Q&A EDU. How about that? Bob?
I'm here.
Thanks for joining us today. I've got Bob, and then on a very special day, the last day or the last recording of 2021 here, also have Jim on. So it's been a while since all three of us have been on at the same time.
I was thinking the same thing. It's been a long time.
Yeah. Jim?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me all right?
We can. Well, all right. Once you speak, yeah.
Okay. It's just weird because for those who don't know, I'm in a different setup. At least I have windows. Bob's
Jim
upstairs
doesn't
in
deal
a windowless...
well with changes.
No, so. Jim does not deal well with change. So, yeah. But anyways, Bob, how do you like the penthouse is what Chris calls that room. How do you like being up there in that little old room?
You know, I think it works great. So there's nothing around to distract me.
See, it's perfect.
Because there's no windows.
He likes it. Yeah.
Bob does like it up there. Okay.
I am
in, just so listeners know, I'm not in the Southern Command Center, as we call my room in my house. I'm in actually my office downstairs from Chris and Bob. Mm-hmm. And Chris has me set up with just different types of equipment that prevent me from actually hearing. So I have half a microphone on my head. Not a microphone. What do I put on my...
Headphones.
Headphones. Mm-hmm. Half a headphone. I have to wear half a headphone to be able to hear everybody. But it's working.
It works fine. We can all hear all right. You. That's the important part. We can
that's
all
the
hear
important
you.
Thing.
And it'll go on the recording. That's what we're looking for.
But I do want to thank everyone, especially you, Bob, for coming on, for making special time for us to do a tax-focused EDU, if you will. With a bunch of questions that we've gathered over the last few weeks, although one or two of them go back further than a few weeks ago. But it is the last EDU show of the year. We have very exciting ideas for next year and areas that we want to take the podcast and topics we want to talk about. But today, I think we'll just jump right into these tax-focused questions unless... anybody wants to bring up anything of importance that we all don't know about that we want to let our listeners know?
Seems like a lot of pressure to come up with something exciting.
Don't
to
all
say.
Jump at once. Okay, so I'm going to guess that's a no for Chris. Bob, anything you want us to bring listeners up, whether about you or life in general?
You know, everything I had my head. Everything is good. I had my head in the tax world so quickly that now I can't think about anything kind of normal.
Okay. Well, I do want to give a shout out to Bob, though. He, unlike you, Chris, refused one of the fresh baked sugar coated cookies downstairs that we have.
I didn't get one.
I gave you the red velvet one last week.
Those weren't sugar cookies.
What the hell do you call them? They're covered in sugar.
Oh, we'll talk afterwards. Sugar cookies is a particular kind of cookie.
So a cookie covered in sugar, you wouldn't call a sugar cookie?
No.
Oh. Okay, well, never mind.
We'll talk about it afterwards.
I handed some to Bob today, and he didn't want it. So you have more willpower than me, Bob, because I had another cookie.
Yeah. I'm trying to, you know, I started the New Year's thing a little early and seeing what I can do about maybe losing a few pounds.
Oh, see, if it was me, I'd be stuffing my face for the next 4 days until it was actually the New Year's.
Seems like I wanted a running start and not.
Okay, I get it.
Well, we're all doing good. I had half a cookie, not a whole cookie. Okay. All righty. So we're going to get into a handful of tax questions. This first one is actually an older one. It came in almost a year ago, came in February of 2021 in light of some issues that were happening back then. But I felt it's still applicable today. So I asked Bob and he was like, yeah, let's quickly lead with this one. So it begins, I am, quote unquote, George from Texas. This is a question for Bob. What will the tax treatment in 2020 for profit and loss from trading cryptocurrencies? Do we have to pay tax if the profit and loss is unrealized? That is, we bought holdings and did not, instead of selling them in 2020? So remember, folks, this came back early in 2021, February of 2021. I'm under the impression, Bob, this gentleman had bought some cryptocurrencies in 2020. They rose in value, and he never sold them. And he's writing to us in February of 2021 asking, does he have to pay taxes on that unrealized gain? That's how I interpret the question. Is that how you interpret it too, Bob?
That sounds right to me, yes.
And I'm hoping he hasn't waited this whole time to file his 2020 taxes waiting for us to answer this because he's a little bit late.
Well, hopefully that's not the case. But the reason I wanted to read it today, a year later practically, was I felt it's still applicable now because of the strong gains in a lot of asset classes in 2021. So anyways, Bob, I'll let you kind of fire out your answer to this gentleman on if he owes taxes on an unrealized cryptocurrency gain.
No taxes due. So think of it like stocks. If you're holding it, nothing is triggered. When you sell it, you have a gain or a loss when you sell the asset, whether that's a stock or a Bitcoin or some imaginary cryptocurrency.
And if he does sell it, how are the gains taxed at that point?
They're taxed as a capital gain or loss, short term, long term, same rules apply over 1 year, long term rates, 1 year or less would be short term, which would be your ordinary income tax rates.
Okay. So, anything you want to add, Chris?
No, this is a kind of a shifting landscape, though. Hasn't there been some changes or proposed changes on how they deal with this?
The one thing that's been kind of talked about, and I don't think it's been passed, but the currently or up until, call it 2022, the wash loss rules don't apply to cryptocurrency. So where you could sell that crypto asset at a loss and replace it the next day, you have a realized loss that you can take for taxes. Capital loss rules apply with the limits and the offsetting of the other capital gains.
Mm-hmm. But no wash sale rules.
No wash sale rules. They were talking about trying to do away with that. They want to do away with that. I am not sure that got passed. That is something.
This is outside of my area of expertise, so I don't know.
I've heard of it, too, that they were contemplating it, but like you, Bob, I don't know if that passed or not. I remember reading about it. If there's any listener out there who knows for sure if that passed, fire us off an email, let us know, and we'll let all our listeners know. But I heard the same thing, too, Bob, that the wash sale rules don't apply to cryptocurrency, so Congress wanted to close that loophole. I just don't know if they did or not.
I'm not sure either. It'd be great to hear from our listeners if somebody is tracking that. The only thing I wanted to add is, what if you spend cryptocurrency, right? You can buy some stuff now, maybe a car.
True. Is there a taxable realization at that point?
Spending cryptocurrency is selling cryptocurrency. So if you use cryptocurrency in some form of a financial transaction to acquire a good or service, that is a realizable sale.
That's good to know, because there are places that accept the cryptocurrency directly. They don't force you to convert it to dollars, which, of course, that would be selling it, you know, turning it back into dollars, if you will. But if they actually accept it, that is seen as a recognition of gain.
Yes, just like you sold it and then used the proceeds to purchase whatever item you were looking at.
Yeah, that's important to remember, especially if it's a sizable transaction. There could be a pretty sizable gain you're recognizing simultaneously with the purchase of whatever it is you're purchasing.
Right.
Conversely, Bob, I would imagine if you used crypto, which I don't do anything, and neither does our firm. We want to make that perfectly clear. I don't even understand it, let alone get involved in it. But if someone is out there and they had crypto and it's actually down because they don't just go up, and they use it to complete a transaction, that would be the realization of a loss, I would assume then, correct?
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's also a record-keeping nightmare, but I don't know how you would possibly track all that. And I don't know. I don't know how that would work. But anyways, I guess that's why there's companies out there that specialize in this. All right, that's about as deep as I wanted to get into that question, unless either of you had anything else you wanted to add.
No, I'd say people pay attention. This is the stuff does change. This is new and evolving. So if you're going to dally in this, make sure you're keeping up on all the rules and consequences.
Okay, perfect. Let's jump into the next one. This is from a New Yorker. Calls himself George, as everyone should. We protect your anonymity, even though he gives his real name. Okay, he begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris." And Bob, people have been giving you shout-outs. We do want you to know that, actually, if you've been listening to the podcast. A lot of people lately have been saying, "Hi, Jim, Chris, and Bob." This person didn't, but we won't hold it against them. But I did want you to know people are giving you shout-outs. Mm-hmm. You're becoming famous in your own right.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, Jim, because recently I was working with a client on some tax planning, and they mentioned hearing that conversation, you guys, about seeing my name pop up more and more in these emails, even though I haven't listened to that particular podcast. I was getting the feedback that way. So I was happy to hear that. Yes.
Excellent. Yeah. So remember that, listeners, if you're right, especially a tax question, you should address it to Bob as well. Okay. Dear Jim and Chris, I love your podcast and I've been learning a great deal, but I don't believe I've ever heard anything on the following. My question deals with Roth conversions, IRMA, and tax filing status. I'm going to pause there. New listeners, if you don't know what this person meant by IRMA, it's income-related monthly. Income-related. Help me out here, Chris.
Monthly adjusted amount.
They do two M's for monthly?
I think there's a Medicare.
No, there's only one M and two A's.
Oh, he's typed it IRMMA.
IRMAA.
Gotcha. Okay. Income related monthly adjusted amount. Okay. That was a user error, not my error. Okay. IRMA, folks, is a surcharge on Medicare premiums if your income is above certain limits. Oh, that's all we're going to say on that. So he says again, my question deals with Roth conversions, IRMA, and tax filing status. I have been doing Roth conversions for several years and have encountered the IRMA penalty when filing joint married due to, our pension income, Social Security income, and the actual Roth conversions. My wife does not have a pension and only moderate Social Security income. Would it be advantageous for us to file married separate and doing Roth conversions in her account since my wife has very low income? Also, how is IRMA figured if both a husband and a wife are collecting Social Security but filing married separate? That was a cue, Bob.
Is that my? Is that why? Yeah. Usually, you have some comment or some lead-in that I was expecting. So I was, I was patiently waiting.
I know when I stopped talking.
Yeah.
And you didn't pick up. I thought, huh? I think he. I need to say something witty, like I usually do, but I have nothing witty to add. So.
So you got to the question mark and you end.
And just stopped.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Fair enough.
So that's a handoff to you, Bob.
We haven't done this three-way kind of thing in a while.
True.
So what we got here, well, you know, it's an interesting concept, and it's probably worth thinking about, but it probably also isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say that, and I'll back up and we'll talk about, so married filing separately is always an option. If you're married, you can always file jointly or elect to file separately, where you and your spouse divide up all your income and your deductions on two separate returns, and you mail them in, and you pay taxes under that filing status in those brackets and at those rates. Typically, you see it more where people are kind of getting separated or they're living apart, and there's different things going on. But occasionally, that status does work, and it does lower the joint tax liability between you and your spouse. So it is a possibility. But keep in mind, a couple of things start to happen, especially with retired folks and specifically IRMA and also the taxation of Social Security are both items that are impacted by the choice of this filing status that you're electing. And so a couple of things, the taxability of Social Security I mentioned, that normally, you know, there's a phase out range of income where sometimes some of your Social Security is not taxed. Sometimes, you know, 50% of it is taxed. Sometimes up to the maximum of 85% of the Social Security benefits you receive before deductions for Medicare are subject to taxation. And those are relatively low phase outs. And there's a phase out range for single and a phase out range for married filing jointly. If you elect marrying filing separately and you live together, mm-hmm. that's the key.
This is the kicker.
Right. If you file marrying filing separately, there are no phase outs. The first dollar of Social Security mm-hmm. received, 85 cents of that is going to be subject to your tax rates.
Right. There's several of these penalties. We're not going to go into all of them today, but there's several tax code, I'll call them penalties because it is uniquely harsh on a tax filer who is filing married filing separate. And this is my own spin. My conclusion is that they are suspicious of those who are married but are electing to file separate, thinking that you're trying to pull one over on them. So they tighten down the rules for those folks. Now, I have no proof of that as to their intent with some of these rules, but imagine this is, you know, of the three status, the filing status, single, married filing joint, married filing separate is distinctly worse than the other two. So, you know, just throwing that out there that there's married filing separate seems like it might be attractive in a lot of cases, but there's these other penalties, we'll call them. And Bob just nailed one of them. The taxability of Social Security, very different, married filing separate.
And living together,
right.
Right. A true penalty. I mean, if you're living apart, physically living in different houses, then what happens, you're subject to the single brackets as a married filing right. separately living right. apart. Still a penalty, but maybe less of a penalty.
And it's living apart the entire year.
Yes.
Not just the last day of the year trying to get it to count. You have to have lived apart the entire year to get out from under this penalty.
That is correct. And then if we look at the IRMA brackets in themselves, okay, so let's say you've looked at this and you're still going down this road of considering this plan. Is this tax planning of marrying and filing separately going to work out? And then if you look at the income limits for IRMA, the same thing happens in the same condition of whether you're living together or living apart. If you're living together, you use the single-tiered IRMA brackets for your additional Medicare Parts B and D. If your status is marrying and filing separately and you're living together, you're squeezing those tiers into two brackets. And the first bracket, which is about $91,000 of modified adjusted gross income, if you go over that, you're at the $374 a month surcharge, which is equivalent to like a tier four.
Right. So it kind of accelerates you through the normal tiers that single filers or married filing joint. The married filing separate, you go from, okay, you're not penalized at first, but as soon as you hit that 91,000 figure, they push you way up the brackets such that there's only really two brackets for the IRMA for married filing separately. There's that first one, and then you get even a slightly higher penalty if you've got really high income. I think for the upcoming year, it's like $400,000 or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Just 409.
Yeah. Yep. So that's the challenge. Now, if you're going to stay under that 91, then maybe there isn't a particular penalty related to IRMA for married filing separately. But boy, if you trigger it, it pushes you way down there to do these huge premiums. The premium for 2022 is going to be $544.30 for someone who's got Maggie over 91,000 married filing separate. So that's, you'd have to climb the ladder a lot as a married filing joint. Well, just as an example, a married filing joint to hit that same premium level, you have to have Maggie of $340,000 between the two of you to hit that same level. As a single person, you'd have to hit 170,000. So what a single person at 170 experiences, you married filing separate, you trigger it at 91. There's a another one of these classic penalties.
Right. So I think in this question, you know, with George from New York, I think if his wife they navigated those bigger loopholes and they stayed below 91,000 modified adjusted gross income, and her Social Security is already being taxed at 85%, you know, when they file jointly, I think what will happen is the brackets and the rates filing as two single people will negate the other benefits of what they're trying to do in total, I think.
Yeah, so it's you'd have to do some calculations. I've had people do this for a variety of reasons, not just IRMA manipulation, but for other, you know, tax reasons, we'll call them. And I would bet, just anecdotally, one time out of 30, someone will say, oh, yeah, there is actually, in this particular case, it is advantageous to marry filing separate. It just is so rare for all the numbers, all the things that get affected to come out in your favor. Maybe tax preparers out there, and Bob, you can comment on this. Do you see it likely, or do you see it very often?
Chris, if memory serves me correct, we had one person that it worked for recently. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I say recently, it could be over the last year. Mm-hmm. I remember you talking to me about the case, and they were going to do separate. Mm-hmm. And you pointed out it's so rare, but in this case it worked.
It's not impossible. So I think you're right. Maybe one in the last couple of years.
We did. But I know we had one. I don't remember when or under what circumstances, but we had one.
Yeah. So it's worth checking into. But Bob, do you run across it where it helps people very often?
You know, maybe a couple times a tax season, it will, in some set of circumstances with just the right numbers. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's on the deductions. Sometimes it's on the income side where it does work out. Fortunately, the tax software we use will automatically clue us in if there is a benefit to switching that. Mm-hmm. And very rarely does it work out. there was a higher chance when the old 2% miscellaneous deductions were around on Schedule A, where one person had a lot of those deductions,
right.
or medical, where you could bring your base down. Sometimes that would work. With those things being gone, it's even more rare.
Yeah. So worth checking, especially if you have the right software. It'll show you what it would look like filing separate, and maybe it would work. Not likely.
Yeah.
Perfect. Let's jump into the next question. This is someone from the fine state of Virginia. So he would be a Virginian.
Very nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, see how I knew that. It begins, hello, Bob. Did you see that, Bob? Your name is first.
First.
I mean, now he is a brown noser, huh? Hi, Bob. Hello, Bob. But he wrote to us in June, so hopefully he doesn't mind waiting so long for the answer. But hello, Bob, Chris, and Jim. Not quite keen on his ordering, but he did say alpha order. So I guess that means alphabetical order. So
also
that makes
maybe tax knowledge order.
I'll concede that both of you are smarter on taxes. Everyone knows I share on the podcast in the office. I'm a financial planner who don't do much planning anymore. I'm too busy running the business. So, yes, I will concede both of you know more about taxes than I do.
It's hard to stay up on it. It gets stale pretty quickly if you're not right on it.
It does. And when you pull out like I've had to, in some cases, I'm still involved in a lot, but not nearly as much as I used to be. And every year it's less and less. Okay, anyways, enough of that. It begins. Thank you for your very informative podcast. Longtime do-it-yourselfer from Virginia. I am 71, turning 72 this year. And remember, he sent this to us in June of 2021, so he is most likely 72 or really, really close to turning 72 since the year's almost over. So I'm 71, turning 72 this year. I am a year younger than my wife. My wife and I are currently retired and taking required minimum distributions. We are also making Roth conversions to top out the 12% bracket. Our traditional IRA amounts are valued at $280,000 and we estimate the value will shrink to $210,000 in 2026. When tax rates are scheduled to return to higher values. After required minimum distributions and continued conversions. So let me pause there. I think what he's saying, and guys, correct me if you think I'm wrong, he's got $280,000 now. He's only trying to fill the 12% bracket. Mm-hmm. So he's estimating by 2026, after doing all those conversions, and I guess adjusting for his expected growth on top of that, he will be down to about $210,000 when the tax laws change back to where they were in January of 2026. Is that your understanding, Bob and Chris, or do you think I am not understanding that right?
No, that sounds to me.
Sounds good to me, yeah. Mm-hmm. Tracking.
Perfect.
Yeah.
My wife has better longevity based on her family history. Therefore, I suspect she will outlive me and will then be in the 22/25 or maybe even higher bracket when the current tax rates change in 2026 or even go up, as many predict. I am currently in good health and expect to live beyond 2026. But as we know, in 2026, the 12% bracket will revert to 15%. We do intend to continue required minimum distributions. You have no choice on that, listener. You'll have to do that. And taking Roth conversions. While the traditional IRA accounts are not very large, our goal is to minimize my wife's tax burden after I die and minimize the tax burden on our two sons after she dies. And that's why we're doing Roth conversions. So let me pause there, listeners, before we get to his question. He is doing what we call on this podcast 210 tax planning. Right there, you can see it clear as day. He and his wife have decided they want to prioritize reducing the taxes in a widower situation. He feels he will pass away first, so it's a widow situation. But they also want to reduce the taxes in a zero situation when both of them have passed away and their sons inherit the money. So that's 210 planning. Are you trying to lower the taxes for two of you, one of you, or none of you? 210. You have to always get that order in priority first in order to do proper tax planning. Because the gist of his questions, you'll see in a minute, listener, are, should they convert beyond the 12%? In other words, should they increase the taxes on two of them in an effort to reduce taxes to one of them or none of them? So their tax priority number is not two, then one, then zero. It's one, then zero, then two. And that is important to keep in mind, because many tax preparers or CPAs, and I'm not throwing the CPA industry under the bus, Bob, at all, but many of them are historical in nature. They're going to take what you did in your taxes last year. They're going to say what you owe on those taxes. And they might tell you what you need to do to lower your taxes this current year. But they're not looking or asking, well, gee, do you want to lower the taxes in a widow-widower situation? Do you want to optimize the inheritance to your children? So because they're not delving into that and asking that, their tax advice is fixated on the couple and lowering taxes for them, when by this gentleman's own admission, he's concentrating because he feels he will pass first on helping his wife reduce her taxes under the widow-widower penalty, which is, remember, she's older than him, and they're only a year behind in age. Even though their IRA isn't that big, she's going to be forced to take required distributions nearly the same size, if not slightly greater, depending on how she handles the IRA after he passes away, as what they're taking as a couple. But that money is going to be passed through, if you will, much smaller brackets. So in dollar terms, they'll pay a lot more in taxes at his death, perhaps. And then they want to, I guess, leave tax-free money to their children. Okay, so I just wanted to pause there, because that's, they hit on the teacup, not the teacup, they hit the on the head of the of nail. A nail.
A pin?
Help me out here. A pin, thank you. They hit the
nail.
Pin.
No,
whoa.
They hit
stop
the nail on the head.
Hit the nail on the head. That's the one. Where the hell did the teacup come from?
Not quite sure.
That one's weird. Is there any saying with a teacup in this situation? Bob, help me out here.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm thinking, but...
I have no idea. I have no idea why I spotted teacup. But remember, folks, I do have a dead spot in my head from my stroke. And apparently it was thinking teacup.
Maybe. Before Bob adds his vast wisdom, which I know he will, the one thing I'd point out to people who might find them, you know, in this particular category, as far as the size of the RMDs and the income recognition from that and doing conversions, they're right in that area where you have to be particularly sensitive with your decisions having an effect on the taxability of your Social Security.
Exactly.
So anybody doing these kind of, you didn't mention Social Security as you read through this question, so I don't think he supplied us with any
information. He didn't ask it, no.
Yeah, but this is an area where he needs to be really careful, particularly doing voluntary conversions on top of RMDs, because the RMD is going to be about $10,000 roughly on $280,000. So to stay within that bracket, that he's got. He's very limited to stay in that 12% bracket, and he might accidentally convert his way into a much bigger portion of his Social Security being taxable. So make sure before you decide on the wise nature of your conversions, that you've taken that part into consideration. And that one's not quite so obvious with people. A lot of people just look at the bracket, they look at the tax on the conversion itself, and they don't notice off to the side, suddenly they're causing a bunch of their Social Security to become taxable that wasn't before. So just wanted to throw that out there. We don't have
that's any. Perfect, because it ties right mm-hmm. into what I'm sure Bob would answer in his question. Because here's what he gets to. Remember, he's worried about dying, but he says he's still fairly healthy right now. So he says, while our traditional IRA accounts are not really large, our goal is to minimize my wife's tax burden after I die and minimize the tax burden on our two sons after she passes away, all by doing Roth conversions. So that's the reason they're doing conversions, folks. 1-0-2. But he does say he's pretty healthy right now, but he does feel his wife will live longer. So he says, over the next few years, I see little to no advantage to increasing the amount we are converting into the 22/25 bracket. What he means by that, slash listeners, January 1st of 2026, the 22 bracket will revert back to 25%. So he then asks, just rhetorically, I guess, do you agree?
Well, that's not
so
rhetorical.
So he's saying, hey, here's what we're doing. Here's our aim. Do you agree, Bob?
I generally agree with that statement, yes. I mean, I always hesitate because until you know everything, mm-hmm. you can never be certain that that would be a bad idea, but it's probably a bad idea. Yeah. And that's where I kind of hesitate. I see in general terms, I don't think converting and paying tax above the 12% bracket would probably be a good idea.
Let me throw out one where it might. And that would be if at the first passing, there's still a bunch of income coming in that doesn't reduce. There's kind of a tax benefit, of course. This is the glass half full thinking here. Less taxes because you have less income. You had to give a bunch of income. But if the income for some reason stays really solid, even after the first of them passes, and he didn't share with us his Social Security or pension info or any of that kind of stuff. If the survivor, in this case, he's anticipating his wife, still has a ton of income coming in, then you might have to, if you're really worried about, if you're really prioritizing 1-0-2, that might be a case. But given what he's told us, I'm certainly on Bob's side that I'm struggling to see a good reason why he should be converting past the 12 bracket.
That's right. And, when we get clients that come to us that are in, these kind of similar situations, and if they came to me and they said, what do you think about this information or our situation here? And our focus is the two. Our focus is on the couple. I would be really concerned that even doing any conversions mm-hmm. would be a wise idea because of what Chris pointed out earlier, the taxability of Social Security can really drive up marginally effective tax rates. And there's not much room after your Social Security is fully taxed into the top of the 12% bracket. We're really squeezed in there. So it could be working for the two. But if that was their priority, I would really look at this hard if that made sense or not. Mm-hmm. Now, with what they're saying, with the one being an issue for them and a priority for them, followed by the zero, I think that 12% bracket, utilizing that 12% bracket would probably be a good idea. Again, I'd watch that Social Security and how it's being taxed, both now during conversions and what's going to happen, say 10 years from now. Is that going to, are those lowering those RMDs going to save taxation on Social Security later on, possibly over a longer period of time? Mm-hmm. All that stuff kind of factors in. But I like how they're looking at the situation. I like how they've identified their order. That makes it very easy for us as planners to look at things the way that we need to look at to match their goals and their priority, and they understand their taxes and how it's going to impact a widower situation, and how it will probably impact their two sons.
Yeah, and the other thing I have to remember on the inheritance, the two sons don't have to worry about the taxability of Social Security issue anymore. So make sure you assess all these before you launch off into a proactive conversion strategy.
I would only add that if his health changes, you would obviously reconsider this. If you all of a sudden are going to have a much shorter life expectancy, listener, you say you're healthy now and you feel you'll live a while. I would also encourage you to let your wife know, if she's not as involved in finances as you are, that if you were to pass unexpectedly and sadly, anybody could, not just you, just out of the blue, pass away very unexpectedly, your wife may want to look at a massive conversion in the year of death, where she will have her last chance on the married brackets. And yes, it might pull in for 1 year some Social Security into taxation, but it could save a heck of a lot more on the tail end, mm-hmm. on the widower tax penalty, and achieving a wonderful tax-free inheritance to the zero, your two sons. And Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but for Irma, wouldn't death be a life-altering event so she would be able to get out of Irma issues with a massive conversion in the year of death?
That's a good.
Or am I wrong?
No, that's a good point, because the loss of a spouse, and this is, you'll find these on form SSA 44. That's the listing. It's called, the title of it is Medicare Income-Related Monthly Adjustment Amount Life-Changing Event. So that's a very long title to this particular publication, if you will. But the they have eight qualifying life-changing events that are kind of like a get-out-of-jail-free card for Irma. And those events are marriage, divorce or an annulment. Those are one together. Death of your spouse, work stoppage, work reduction, loss of income producing property, loss of pension, or employer settlement payment. Those are the eight. There it is, number three, death of your spouse. So that is a life-changing event that you can file, and they will then recalculate your IRMA based on current information rather than past information. So if you did something in that year, the year of death, the years after that should be shielded from IRMA effects, unless your other income causes you to be in there anyway. But any specific strategies you deploy in that year shouldn't linger on you for that normal, you know, 2 years delayed IRMA creation, which is what we usually see with IRMA. If those, so I'm not going to go any deeper than that. But yes, it is a, I guess the short answer to your question, yes, that is a life-changing event for IRMA calculations.
So she could do, in the year of death, if you died unexpectedly, a big conversion, not subject herself to IRMA with the get-out-of-jail-free card. On that big conversion, she will subject Social Security to taxation, but that might be a small price to pay for 1 year to get a huge conversion done. Bob, do you see any problem with that? Or at least it would be a case-by-case analysis, but I'm just trying to get him to make sure she knows to do this if something happened to him. Do you agree, disagree?
I agree. That can work out really well, and we've used that strategy recently. When the spouse passed away, we had the opportunity, and in this case, with one last year of married filing jointly, and not thinking about the impact of IRMA, because we know we can get out of that, that entire account could be converted at no more than 24%, and there's no IRA money. And what does that look like again with specifics down the road? Do we have somebody that's gonna now be, you know, as a single filer for a long period of time, and maybe out of the tax, you know, market altogether?
So one could almost argue, if he does feel he will pass away first, and is, I guess it's irrespective of who dies first, maybe their strategy is to do no conversions, or just keep filling the 12 bracket, because why waste it? But the strategy is at the death of the first spouse, because these dollar amounts are so relatively small and they can get out of jail free with IRMA, that's when the massive conversion is done. So there's no need to go into the 2225 now. They just wait till death. And in the meantime, just fill the 12%. Maybe that's their strategy. Whether he dies first or she dies first, that would take care of the one. That would optimize the one while helping the two right now not pay a lot in taxes until the year of death. Just a thought. I don't know if it makes sense or not, but that's what's running through my head.
You'd have to be careful over converting, because you wouldn't want the single person then to waste. There is still going to be a 12%, well, 15% bracket by then for the single person. You wouldn't want to reduce your income so much that you're not even filling into that bracket. So, you know, we'd have to know all their other income sources and what income is still going to be around post the first passing. But you wouldn't necessarily do the whole thing, 100% of it. But you could do a big chunk of it, and then hopefully then leaving yourself with RMDs that might keep you down in the 15% bracket for a single person.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I guess the moral of this story, folks, especially for you do-it-yourselfers, if you're not both involved, both listening to the podcast, both knowing what you're doing, make sure if you are the main person, it could be male or female, we've seen both, in our practice, who lead. It's not just the man. It's not just the woman. Sometimes it's the man. Sometimes it's the woman. Make sure the other spouse knows these strategies. And, hey, this is what you got to do if I pass away unexpectedly. Or even when I pass away, just have it laid out. Leave instructions is what I'm getting at. Leave instructions of what they should be doing, also where the money is, how the money's invested, why is it invested that way? If you're working with an advisor, who is the advisor, how to reach them? Here's the tax person, here's the attorney. But definitely this strategy on converting, lay it out. Make sure they understand it. Don't just tell them. They may forget. They're going to be mourning. Write it out. Lay it out. So even your children or executor of the estate or trustee of your trust, if there's one, can read it and say, oh, God, this was the strategy. They're going to do a big conversion in the year of death. Okay, that makes sense. Let's make sure we do it. Okay, anyways, that's my thoughts. I don't want to keep harping on this. Bob, is there anything else you want to add?
No, the only thing I would mention is what we don't know, you know, in this particular case, is what's going to happen with the pension income and how much pension income is there. And is that going to continue to the surviving spouse? Because following up with what Chris was saying, it's hard to know that in the future, if you're able to collect Social Security tax-free for a long period of time, that benefit can be huge. And if you don't have that benefit, then you want to continue to use those lower brackets. But if that benefit happens to be available, it has to be measured, because that can be huge and it can create value in doing a larger conversion.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go on to the next. We got two more questions to go. This is from George and Georgette in the fine state of Pennsylvania. It says, hi, we love to listen to your podcast while driving to visit my mother every week. Well, isn't that nice? Going to visit the mom. I think that's nice. She wants to gift the grandkids stock, which has appreciated significantly through the years. The thought was the grandkids could sell the stock without much tax implications. One grandchild is 23 and has just attend graduate school fall of next year. I think they're saying will be attending graduate school next fall. And they're 23.
You skipped a line.
I think, yeah. Thanks.
Where did I skip a line?
Between the last one you just said and the next.
One grandkid is 23 and has just started working with limited income this year.
Oh, I did skip a damn line. Okay. See, I got a dead spot in my head. You guys keep forgetting.
That's why we're here, for support.
Thank you.
Get you back on track.
I'm on track. The thought was that the grandkids could sell the stock without much tax implication. One grandchild is 23 and has just started working with limited income this year. The other grandchild is 21 and graduated college this year in May and will attend graduate school fall of next year. Yeah, that reads much better than the way I read it.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this strategy good as far as taxes are concerned? Or should the grandkids hold on to the stock until they are older? We are worried about the kiddie tax. Thanks for your informative and entertaining show, George and Georgette from Pennsylvania.
Well, this is my turn.
Yes.
Okay,
yes, sir.
I'm learning.
It's all you.
Yeah. Yeah, so we got a couple things to kind of chat about here, right? We have, well, conceptually, if you're able to take an appreciated asset, appreciated stock, pass that along to somebody younger and or likely to be in a lower tax bracket, what you're doing is taking that capital gain that you would recognize if you sold the stock and just gave them a check, and you're saying, let's give the capital gain to the grandkids and allow them to sell the stock and recognize the gain and likely have a benefit of paying little or no tax on that long-term capital gain. And you know, that in itself is a good tax planning opportunity. And there's some considerations about, you know, the amount. Let's say if we don't want to file an annual gift tax return, you know, we know $15,000 from grandmom to grandchild would be free and unreportable. So that would be nice. If it's more than $15,000, it's not a big deal. There's no gift tax due. There would be a gift tax return due where the lifetime exemption of grandmom would just be reduced, and there's plenty of that for most people. The kiddie tax issue, they're both in the kiddie tax group because kiddie tax is a tax on unearned income for certain kids that are still potentially claimed as a dependent on their parents' return, or they qualify to be claimed as a dependent on their parents' return, and their unearned income, such as capital gain income, exceeds $2,300. That income could drag them into kiddie tax because of their age and because of their student status. Certainly for the 21-year-old, because he or she is going into graduate school and they're under age 24. The older one is probably out of kiddie tax. One grandkid's 23 and has just started working. So if the 23-year-old's out of school, no kiddie tax applies. Mm-hmm. It's going to fall solely back on their tax brackets and rates, and likely to be something that they could sell at reduced or potentially no capital gain or tax due. Mm-hmm. What happens when the 21-year-old, if they were to sell this highly appreciated stock and generate capital gains, say over that $2,300 unearned income level, then some of that's going to get taxed on the middle generation, the parents' tax rates. And that's the part about the listener is saying, you know, maybe it makes sense to hold that for a little while and not subject that to maybe what that middle generation's tax rates might be. The other thing to consider for the younger one that's going into graduate school is if their income, and, you know, if they're working as a graduate student assistant or in that role, and they're able to support half of themselves, that gets them out of kiddie tax as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if they were a little younger, if they were undergrads, I'd be a little worried about jeopardizing some financial aid possibly. But going into graduate school, that's generally not an issue because most of that for graduate school is not so much needs-based. Although that's not my area of expertise, there might certainly be some out there, but it is less for graduate school. I think you're going to have to look at the tax status, whether you should be really that concerned or not. And they also don't give us any dollar amounts. I mean, we might be talking about small enough numbers that it's not really that big a deal to worry about. But I don't recall them giving us any round numbers here. If this is a significant amount of dollars we're talking, or just a little bit.
That's right. Yeah, if it was a few thousand in that range, not too big of a deal. Mm-hmm. Larger amounts, you know, some more planning and consideration of the kiddie tax for at least one of the grandchildren would come into play. And then the investment itself, of course, is do you want to sell it or hold it? And then in much, much larger numbers, there is a generation skipping tax. But we're talking about, you know, something in excess of $12 million or something right now. So not too concerned about that either. But for the average gifting to help out grandkids, these are things to think about.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I would add is the grandmother should chat a little bit, or what we don't have, I guess is where I'm going with this, is the health of the grandmother. And it very well may be if the grandmother's health is not good, and I hope it is good. It is your personal mother, listener. I hope her health is really good. But let's talk openly. If it's not, and it may be shortened, whether it's by a few years or even a decade or so, you may want to rethink gifting highly appreciated stock to begin with, assuming the grandmother is comfortable with the strategy, and that is passing on to the children at death, and it'll escape all taxation with the step-up in basis. So it's just a thought to keep in mind. Your grandmother or your mom, their grandmother, could actually open up a brokerage account for each child, say, in her name, but naming each grandchild as a TOD, transfer on death account. So it won't even go through probate. And she can put the stock into that every year. There's no gift tax. There's no issues. There's no nothing. It's still in her name. But she's mentally moving that money off to the children. And it's in an account. This might be good because these children are young. Maybe they would misspend this money or something. Or maybe she doesn't put it all in. Maybe she says, hey, I was going to do $10,000 a year per child. I'll give them $1,000, but I'm going to put $9,000 in their brokerage account, say. This is, again, if her health is not that great, because if she passes, all the taxation would escape. And it would go outside of probate with the transfer on death status, and the children would have it 100% tax-free and could sell it. Now, of course, if her aim is to help them pay for either schooling or to buy a car or buy a house, no, the strategy won't work. But if she's just giving money to be nice, but the children don't necessarily need it, now granted, the grandkids are going to be, oh, no, shut up, Jim, we need it. I get that. But it's just something to think of. It doesn't have to be all or nothing either. She could put some in my brokerage strategy and some give outright. Just saying. But hopefully she's healthy and this is a moot point. But if not, it's something to consider.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I always suspect it was the goal is maybe to help them sooner than later, but depending on what the numbers are, maybe you can help them and they still can recognize the gain 0% if the tax issues all align properly. But that is certainly something to think of as a backup. If it's not urgent, you get them the money now, and it's more just we want to set it off to the side for them. I always like the benefits of the step-up. Now, the event that has to happen for the step-up is not positive. Someone has to pass away. But that should always be part of the considerations for estate planning is what's going to happen at passing and when is it, you know, anticipated to happen roughly.
Correct. And it doesn't mean if she did this strategy, folks, she can't turn around and just give the stock later. If the children are getting married or if there's a medical emergency or something like that. So there's just mm-hmm. something to consider. It doesn't have to be gifting all or nothing. And there is a step up in basis potential.
Yep.
Okay. Last question. And it's from a gentleman in Indiana. He gives his real name, but we're going to call him as always. We call him George. Okay. So it says, I have a question about Roth contributions for a married filing jointly couple. My wife worked, and I won't name the company. My wife worked for a company in the first quarter of 2021, giving vacations at nursing homes and assisted living facilities.
Vaccination.
Not vaccinations, I'm sorry. okay, giving vaccinations at nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Her gross pay was $17,300, and she contributed 80% of it to her Roth 401k. We are both 66, and she does not have any other W-2 income, and I have no W-2 income. Our modified adjusted gross income will be below the $198,000 limit for contributing to a Roth. We do plan to make Roth conversions to move our adjusted gross income up to about $160,000. To do some tax planning by moving money out of our always taxable IRA and lower our future required minimum distributions. My question is, what is the math or rules about making contributions to her Roth IRA and my Roth IRA as a spousal contribution? Since she contributed to her Roth 401k, can we also contribute to the Roth IRAs? We have plenty of savings in maybe taxable accounts to fund these contributions. Thank you for your support to help the Schwabi, or soon to be
Schwabi.
Oh my Lord, why the hell did I even try that word? What is that word?
Schwabitadian, which is not a word we've ever used, but could be a term for someone from Schwab.
Oh, TD Ameritrade, Schwabitadian, get
there
it?
There you go, yeah. Mm-hmm. We have not okay. used that, but that's,
no.
Yeah, Schwabitadian.
Wow, I was looking, I should read these ahead of time because I would have never tried that word. Okay, so let me repeat what he was saying. Thank you for all the support you help the Schwabi, or soon to be Schwabitadian, Tadian, do-it-yourselfers.
I think it might be okay, a little better as Schwabitradian, but...
Oh, Schwabitradian, that would have been much better. Yeah,
but he doesn't have the R in there, so that's not your mispronunciation. He just says Tadian, but I think it rolls a little better off the tongue as Schwabitradian.
Schwabitradian, I like that. See, now that I like, Schwabitradian.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, Charles Schwab bought TD Ameritrade over a year ago, and the transaction is complete, but the merger is not. Merger is going to be complete in 2023, and it's not going to be called Schwabitrade. It's going to keep the Schwab name.
Right.
Okay, your turn, Bob. How would you help this person?
Okay, so a couple of things to look at. Let's start with Roth contribution, I guess the basic rules. We have an income limit rule, which we're okay with, married filing jointly under 198. Mm-hmm. It's got a quick phase out. It's only a $10,000 phase out for some reason. On those.
So that means they're allowed. That's the first thing to check, is that they haven't exceeded the modified AGI number that bars them from making Roth IRA contributions directly. So they're okay there.
So we got past the income limit. Now to contribute to a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA, the other thing you need to have is earned income. Wages count, you know, self-employment income counts, alimony counts. So we need some earned income. So we have a wife working at a store with gross pay of $17,300, contributing to her Roth 401k. She's contributing to an employer plan with after-tax dollars, so we're not reducing box one of our W-2. That's good. That's going to show up on the tax return and allow us to count that as earned income for both her and the spouse filing a joint return. Only one person has to have earned income to cover the earned income rule for both spouses. Right. So in this case, we know we can contribute $6,000 each plus another $1,000 each because they're both over age 50 catch-up contribution. Yep. So if we have $14,000 of box one W-2 income, we can contribute $14,000 to a Roth this year.
Well, $7,000 each.
Right.
Just make sure.
Yep. $7,000 each. But. Yep. And no problem with that. And no problem with the contribution of the 80% of her gross pay to her Roth 401k.
Right. Isn't that weird? I mean, that's they've kind of identified some weirdness that's allowed in the rules. They've got $17,300 of earned income, but qualify to make, in this case, and they could have qualified to make more. She could have contributed the entire amount to the Roth 401k. $27,840 is looking like what they're trying to contribute to Roths in a combination of 401k and IRA, which is well in excess of what she actually earned in earned income.
It's a pretty good case. I mean, I mm-hmm. like this question because it comes up every once in a while, mm-hmm. and it really goes to show you in some ways how much you're able to save. You're not getting a tax deduction necessarily, but you're able to get quite a bit of money into a Roth facility, Roth plan, 401k, IRA, and they're making conversions. So clearly their strategy is to try to build their Roth funding, and it works out pretty well. It's interesting the ability to contribute like that into your own work plan, 401k plan. When you make that election as an employee, you're making in a salary deferral form. You're making an election to defer your salary. And technically, you're deferring your salary and you're allowing your employer to make that contribution, which is the slight but distinct difference between excluding that contribution from your ability to do your normal $6,000 or $7,000. And that's the sort of the technicality of why they both can concur or happen in concurrent form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not too many people are going to do that, but they have these other resources, mm-hmm. and their goal is to fill up that Roth, and this is a way they can fill without doing conversions. So,
it's interesting handy case. That they have. Mm-hmm. It's handy that they have enough money. They said mm-hmm. in maybe taxable accounts like bank and brokerages to make these contributions. Mm-hmm. So it's a no-brainer. I agree.
And put have access to in. That work connected 401k, which allowed them to make that big extra contribution.
Your wife should keep vaccinating people again to do it again in 2022 if she can.
Yeah,
because it's a wonderful way to get money into a Roth.
Yeah, perfect.
And keep in mind, just one spouse has to have earned income mm-hmm. on a joint return, and both spouses can utilize that as far as the calculation of the mm-hmm. of the contribution amount. And that's the K. Bailey Hutchinson Act.
Mm-hmm. And you can't count. You can't double count the same dollars. So if she only had, say, $7,000, that's completely changing the facts of the case here. But if only had $7,000 worth of earned income, you can't each put $7,000 into a Roth because that would be double counting that seven. You've got to have $14,000 at least, which they have $17,000 plus, so they make it. But to put $14,000 in between the two of you, you've got to have $14,000 of combined wages on there. Just wanted to make that clear so people didn't think, oh, as long as we have seven, we can do it as a married couple because we can share in that. No, you can't share it like that. But any excess you have over your seven, your spouse can take advantage of. That's kind of how it's working, is you're using your seven, and then your spouse gets to use up to another seven. So as long as you've got 14 and over, you can make full-blown contributions with catch-ups.
Yeah, where I've seen things go a little bit when they're close like this, mm-hmm. just as a follow-up comment, is if she was eligible for some kind of health plan or an HSA plan. I think they might be above the age limit for that. I'm not sure. But anything that reduced that income on a pre-tax dollar, forget about the savings plans, but let's look at like pre-tax medical or HSA contribution. And she reduced that $17,300 down below $14,000 through that kind of deferred salary planning. Mm-hmm. That's going to cut into that $14,000 and start to reduce what they can do.
Right.
And I've seen that where people think they're okay, but they get their W-2 mm-hmm. and it's like, wait a minute, our W-2 is only $13,000.
Right, exactly.
And they have to, recharacterize or pull money out or something.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. So be on the lookout for that as well. Okay.
All righty. Well, that wraps up all the tax related questions we have. We've got a few more. So Bob, I'm sure we would like you to come back on the show if you don't mind to answer them. And if anybody has questions for Bob, feel free to send them to us. Chris will explain to you in a minute how to do that. But unless we have anything else to talk about, are we going to wrap it up, Chris?
I think so. We won't be able to get any more tax questions this year. We'll have to wait till next year.
Yeah, it's a long time away.
So I could come back next year and do some more shows.
You can come back next
shows.
Year. Right. Although we'll have to squeeze you in quick before it gets too much into tax prep season, because then it's going to be hard to get a hold of you. So
yeah,
we'll probably have to turn around and do one fairly soon, otherwise leave you alone until the end of April.
Can I get one quick plug in?
Certainly.
Sure.
So we still have a little capacity for our tax prep team. And so if anybody out there is listening to us or wanting a change or some different, maybe some different insight or input, reach out to us as well, and we can see if we can be a good fit, match up, and handle your tax prep services.
Yeah, and with that, thank you for announcing that. That's very important. But don't confuse listeners' tax preparation, which is what Bob will be doing pretty much, February, March, and April. You don't really start in January, do you?
We can get a few things out of the way, but the stuff is primarily coming in early February.
Yeah. So preparation is just helping you do your 2021 taxes in early 2022 to file. Where we don't have capacity is with tax planning, the advanced tax planning that we do for Roth conversion analysis, withdrawal analysis, just strategies that retirees need to look at. As Chris and I had announced about a month or so ago, Chris, we have put a pause on accepting new clients for about a year. We anticipate unpausing in 2023. But 2022 is going to be a year of transition for our firm. I use the euphemism or analogy, if you will, of a caterpillar that's gone into its cocoon and will emerge as a butterfly or a moth, I guess, depending on what kind of caterpillar is going in there. So our firm is going to be evolving, and that's part of what I am doing. And Chris and Bob are concentrating on existing clients and prospects who are waiting for their services. So do keep in mind, folks, even though we're not accepting new retirement planning and tax planning clients now, Bob does have capacity for tax preparation. But you can also get a hold of our office. You can email admin@jimhelps.com. You'll actually be reaching Mayanna, Chris's lovely daughter, who works for us. And she is collecting names of people who would like to be contacted in late 2022, early 2023. When we're getting ready to begin accepting new tax planning and new retirement planning clients, she'll be reaching out to those people first to let them know that Chris and I are contemplating opening. We will be able to review with you our pricing structure and what services we have available. So if anybody is interested in that, you don't have to be. It's we don't push it on the show, as you know, but we do get callers every now and then. Listeners who call and reach out and would like to work with us or hire us, but we don't have capacity and we're not taking on retirement planning and tax planning now. But get on that list that Mayanna is keeping, because she'll reach out to those people long before Chris and I let our existing clients know in case they wanted to refer people to us, long before we let existing clients know for referrals or podcast listeners for new people. We're going to reach out to those first to give them an opportunity to work with us if they so choose. The only other thing that I would add with that, since we're kind of putting a little station identification commercial in here, our firm does still offer investment management services. Chris and I don't talk about that a lot on the podcast, but we are going to do a whole series of shows on that, specifically why we manage assets the way we do, how we manage them, why we price it the way we do, what we don't like about the financial services and asset management industry. And there's a lot we don't like about it, and there's a lot we do like about it. So we're going to do a whole series of shows on that very soon. But that part of our practice is still open. We just want people to understand that our planning takes a lot of time if done correctly. It is not scalable. The more clients, the easier it gets, does not apply to planning and tax planning. So that's what we have closed down. Asset management is very computerized. It's very scalable with the technology we have. But tax planning, that requires Bob's knowledge. He's got 20 plus years of knowledge. There's no software that does what Bob does. There's software that gives him the data he needs, but he has to analyze it himself. Same thing with retirement planning. There's no software that tells Chris, this is exactly what this person should do. The software just gives Chris the data. It's his knowledge that puts together the plan. That's not scalable, and that we put a pause on to give us more time to evolve the firm in the direction we want it to go. Anyways, I just want to mention that every now and then, Chris and Bob, sorry to hog the mic for that little bit, but I do want to point that out to listeners.
Okay. Well, thanks for that clarification. And if you do want to send in anything to us, reach out to us for any particular reason, you can go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there, there's a contact form. If you've got questions for the show you'd like us to consider for the podcast here, you can send them through that contact form on the webpage, or you can send them directly to Jim. His email is jim@jimhelps.com. And perfect. Well, you both have a nice rest of your year, and we'll be back with everyone else with a brand new show. Next show is a Q&A show, and it'll release on the 1st, so it'll be 2022. So thanks for listening to the final show of 2021, and good health and good luck in the coming year. We'll be back with you shortly with another new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.